From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They are titans of oil, operating systems, military industrial giants, and entertainment. And for the most part, the first $1 billion in personal net worth is par for the course, even puny. From 31-year-old Google co-founder Sergey Brin to 96-year-old oil tycoon Max Fischer, they range in age and geography, but not in economic class. Tonight on Point, an up-close look at the richest Americans and what their economic power means for the rest of the country. But first, oil prices slipped over the $50 a barrel mark today for the first time ever, and analysts say they may go higher still. Clashes between the army and rebel militants in Nigeria and hurricanes over the oil-rich Gulf of Mexico have helped push the price of oil to its historic high. But it's not just war and weather behind the bump-up. Bob Tippy is editor-in-chief of Oil and Gas Journal. He joined me from Houston. I asked him, what is driving the price of oil so high?
Primarily unexpected demand. Demand primarily for gasoline in the United States and all oil products in China, which has sort of caught everybody off guard and has pretty much used up all the reserves in the system, which is inventories and spare production capacity.
So that's on the demand side. More demand for gas in the U.S., isn't that a fairly constant number?
No, it fluctuates seasonally, but gasoline demand has been pretty stout in the United States for the past several years, partially because of a strong economy, and also after 9/11, there was a strong preference for driving instead of flying, and that kept gasoline demand high even when the economy was having its problems. So gasoline demand has been strong and stayed strong this year, and that happened at a time when crude oil prices were high because of this real strong demand growth from China.
And, of course, that's a relatively new factor as well, China's economic development, meaning it's just gobbling up oil. How big a factor is China's voracious demand for oil?
Well, you're talking about double-digit consumption growth per annum, which is really significant in a market that usually grows worldwide 2 to 3%. So China is a big factor. Now, its total consumption doesn't approach that of the United States by any means at this point, but it's just that it's out there competing for crude oil and for oil products with other countries that need it, and doing so at a time, as I say, when inventories have been low and where there have been some real threats to supply. So the market's got a lot of things to worry about.
Now, that's the other side of this equation. Go through some of the supply threats. We know some of them, I guess. I mean, Hurricane Ivan has gotten in the way of deliveries in the Caribbean. Then there's trouble in the Middle East. But how would you rank the supply problems?
Well, today, this week, the big concern is Nigeria, where there's a threat of a strike and also some tribal problems down in the oil-producing region of the country.
With the Nigerian army clashing there with regional militants.
Yes, yes. That's almost 2.5 million barrels a day from that country at a time when spare production capacity in the whole world is probably no more than 1.5 million barrels a day. So people who make their living trading and selling crude oil and oil products have to worry about being caught short, and they can see that if something happens that takes Nigeria totally off stream for a while, other producers aren't going to be able to take up the slack, and that creates tension in the market, and people will say, well, that's just psychological, but it's a real factor. It's something the market has to contend with.
And this at a time when commercial oil inventories in the U.S. are, we understand, close to a 29-year low. Saudi Arabia announced today that it would crank its production up from 9 million barrels a day to, what was it, 11 million barrels. How big a difference is that? Will it make a difference in the price?
I think the Saudi announcement, it's that kind of number, they're probably talking about adding to production capacity rather than actual production. Production capacity takes a little longer to come back, and it's, while it's a bit of a reassurance to the market, it doesn't resolve the immediate tension. I know the Saudis have been producing over 9.5 million barrels a day, which is pretty close to capacity, although they can get that up to 10 million barrels a day and over fairly quickly. But they're producing pretty much flat out at the moment, with an uncomfortably thin margin of idle capacity that they can tap in the case of an unwanted surge in demand.
So demand at record highs globally, supply problems all over the place. Put this $50 mark in historical context for us, Bob. In constant dollars, when was the last time the price of oil was this high?
I think it, in real terms it was probably higher in the late 70s, early 80s perhaps. In real terms, we're not at record high levels. And there's another side of that, at least in the United States, that there are income effects. Our incomes have increased fairly steadily over the years, and the amount in percentage terms that we spend on gasoline and other oil products has actually shrunk, and shrunk fairly dramatically. So when the price of gasoline, for example, goes up, it's not as big a bite out of our budgets as it used to be. That doesn't mean we don't feel it. We certainly do. But that, you know, it says a couple things. One, it means that we've had a period of remarkably cheap fuel for a while. And it also means that we can afford it more now than we could the last time fuel prices in real terms were anywhere near this level.
On the other hand, we're reading analysts saying today that the price of oil could go substantially higher given that demand and the checkered supply situation, that there's no real cap at the moment on where it might go.
I know better than to predict oil prices because they are so unpredictable. At some point, we will see a demand response. We will see a turnaround in demand. Prices cannot increase indefinitely without moderating demand and also without summoning new supply onto the market. Oil production that's barely economic, you know, when the price is 30 begins to look attractive when it's 50, and somebody will go there and start producing it if they think the price is going to stay there for a while. So the market does adjust, and it adjusts constantly and often and kind of invisibly for a while until the effects show up. So there is a cap on price at some point. I just can't tell you what it is. Now, that said, if Nigeria goes off stream, there's another hurricane in the Gulf, and or something happens in another place that's had political problems, Venezuela, you know, if two of those things were to happen at the same time, there'd be certainly a strong increase in price. It wouldn't last forever, but the price would get to levels that would certainly have us concerned for a while.
I guess we'll keep our fingers crossed. Bob Tepe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bob Tepe is editor-in-chief of Oil and Gas Journal. He spoke with me from Houston. The Forbes 400 is an annual accounting of the richest of Americans. And this year, they are richer than ever. $1 trillion in personal net worth between them. In a country where more wealth is now concentrated in fewer hands than at any time in generations. The Forbes list also reveals how the wealthy get there. 34 members of this year's Forbes 400 made their fortunes in oil. 45 in media. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Tonight on Point, the richest Americans and what their fortunes mean for the country. Are you on the list? Aspiring to be? Wondering how their wealth and your life interact in business, in politics, in our American culture? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Matthew Miller. He's a reporter for Forbes magazine, and he spent the last year tracking down the richest of the rich. Matt Miller, thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
You old magnate, you, Jack. Matt Miller, amazing figures. The 400 richest, cumulatively more than a trillion this time. You've sliced and diced and dissected this list and gone into it in so many ways. Give us the Learjet tour or the Gulfstream tour. I'm not sure what's most popular these days among the super rich. What should we know about this 400?
Well, it's actually the Gulf, the G5, Gulfstream G5. That's
but of course,
the billionaires prefer
them.
To fly these days. That's what they tell me.
Okay.
Let's see. We can just take this a number of different ways. The top 10 is actually Bill Gates, $48 billion.
And he's 48 years old, so there's a nice symmetry there this year for Bill.
Nice symmetry. He's up about $2 billion from last year. Microsoft stock trading well.
And speaking of up, you report that overall this list made their net worth increased by $45 billion last year. Not a bad net gain.
Not a bad net gain. We can attribute some of that to the stock market being up in certain sectors. We can attribute some of it to me just going out there along with my fellow reporters and finding new billionaires. As we put more billionaires on the list, especially from the private sector that we didn't know about earlier. The minimum, which is the price of admission to get on the list, is $750 million this year. And so as those numbers go up, you'll actually see the cumulative wealth top $1 trillion. It's not the first time this happened. In 2000, when we had the internet bubble, it topped $1 trillion.
But 78% of those on the list with fortunes of $1 billion or more. And I interrupted your top 10. There's Bill Gates still at number one. Warren Buffett right behind him at $41 billion.
Paul Allen at $20 billion. Then we have five Waltons. They are the children of Walmart founder Sam Walton. They're each worth $18 billion, down about $2 billion each this year. Michael Dell's up at $14.2 billion at number nine, and Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle, at $13.7 billion, round up the top.
And you were
10.
Saying Warren Buffett, the great stock market guru, is he up or down at $41 billion this year?
He's actually up $5 billion this year, the biggest mover. It was interesting. This spring, we were looking very closely at Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett actually came within a couple $100 million of Bill Gates. Berkshire Hathaway stock was actually flirting at $100,000 a share. They've never split that, and so it's quite pricey. He was very close to Bill, and then Microsoft paid the dividend. Their stock went up a little bit, and then Berkshire fell off. So $7 billion difference between number one and number two.
41 women on the list this year. How many? By the sweat of their brow, how many by inheritance, how many by marriage?
It's 51 women this year.
Oh, excuse me, 51.
And it's okay. At least that's what the paper in front of me says.
Okay.
They have an average net worth of $2.8 billion, which is actually higher than the list average, which is $2.5 billion list average. Split it up, it's probably about 60% have inherited and 40% are self-made.
Oprah's on that list. Who else among
women has
worked her way on the list?
Let's see. Abigail Johnson's actually number one in terms of working women. She owns 24% of Fidelity, which is up in your neck of the woods in Boston. They manage about $1 trillion in assets. She's worth $12 billion.
So she's in that category where Papa was there, but she's a very active part of Fidelity's management.
Actually, Grandpa was there for Abby. Some of the Walton daughters are actually up there at 18. Five, they obviously inherited their net worth. Let's see, other women here. Maggie Whitman or Meg Whitman.
eBay.
She works for eBay. She's worth $1.6 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Marianne Sanders, Sandler, excuse me. She's worth $920 million. She actually is involved in retail banking out in San Francisco.
And Teresa Hines Carey just makes it onto the list this year.
Yeah, she's back on at the minimum. The way we figure Teresa Hines Carey, the last time she was on the list was 1998, and she was on at $675 million. We can't see what she holds in Hines stock anymore. So the way we did it was we put together a model assuming that she sold a certain number of millions of shares each year for estate planning and then put it into different kind of sectors of the economy, either treasuries or hedge funds or something in between those. And she, assuming those variables, were able to put her on back on at the minimum this year.
Matt Miller, stand by. We're going to be looking a lot at this list of the rich tonight. But, Jack Beatty, we also want to put it in a context. That is, we live in a time when the concentration of wealth in this country is at, well, its highest level in generations, which is sort of a distinguishing characteristic of wealth in the 90s and now in the early 2000s.
It sure is. As recently as 1976, the top 1% had 19% of the wealth. Today they have 40%. This has happened before, and it's interesting to compare the two eras. In 1860, the top 1% had 29% of the wealth. In 1890, they had 50%. How did they get it? Railroad money through government favors. And what did they do with it? They extensively corrupted politics. In the 1870s, the Union Pacific Railroad, its executives spent $500,000 annually on bribes. The House of Representatives was referred to as an auction room. At the presidential level, Jay Gould, the railroad corrupter, purchased purchased the 1880 election, gave James Garfield enough money to have him buy Indiana. Indiana elected him. And when we come back, I'll tell you how the country responded.
And on it goes. We're going to look at the impact of these wealthiest of the wealthy on American business, American politics, American culture and society. You can join the conversation tonight. The least wealthy member of the Forbes 400 is worth $750 million. How close did you come? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the wealthiest Americans and what their wealth means for the rest of the country. Matt Miller's with us. He's a reporter with Forbes magazine. They've just come out with their annual Forbes 400, sort of minimum price of admission, $750 million. 78% of the wealthiest Americans with personal net worth of $1 billion or more, and many fortunes of many, many billions. What do you think? Are you celebrating the $1 trillion net worth of the 400 richest Americans tonight? What are the implications of the greatest concentration of American wealth in decades? And how is the concentration of so much wealth in so few hands shaping American society, American politics, the American economy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack, I had to interrupt you. You were in the midst of one of these early run-ups in great American wealth and its concentration, and you were about to get to how the public ultimately responded.
Yes, this was the Gilded Age, an earlier plutocratic age, and I mentioned how the House of Representatives and the presidency were variously corrupted, but the state governments were even more crapulent. A Missouri railroad spent over nearly a half a billion dollars basically buying out the Missouri legislature to escape from some of its debts. It was said of Standard Oil that it did everything to the Pennsylvania legislature except refine it. And, you know, what was the response? Well, of course, the populist revolt, Teddy Roosevelt, the malefactors of great wealth, that's what he called these people, and efforts to deal with them at every level of government. Well, really, the two outstanding ones for the individuals were the progressive income tax of 1913 and the inheritance tax, federal income tax of 1917. Both were aimed directly at the plutocracy. And they have pretty much been doing that ever since. But what's been happening? Since 1980, the top rate on the income tax has fallen from about 70 to 39%. And President Bush lowered it a little bit more. In his second term, he's talking about a flat tax, which, of course, would eliminate progressivity entirely. He's also talking about a sales tax, which might even eliminate the income tax also. And what does he want to do with the inheritance tax? Well, he wants to abolish it. So we're going back to the future. And today, we're almost sort of right back to where we were, or the direction is to going right back where we were in 1890 in terms of favoritism toward the wealth in the tax code. And what do we have as a Democratic nominee? Is he talking about malefactors of great wealth? Hell no, he's married to a billionaire.
Come over here, Teresa.
She's not a billionaire, guys.
Not quite, but getting close. Jack, we've got it. Matt Miller, you can hear the critical perspective and what Jack's presenting there. Of course, Forbes celebrates this list. When you look
Absolutely.
At it this year, is it a sign of the health of the economy? How do you read it?
Well, yeah, it's a sign of the health of the economy. The $45 billion swing between last year and this year, just because it topped $1 trillion. You know, look, the top 400 richest people were rich last year. They're rich again this year. The way I see this list and how I approach this, when we talk about celebrating capitalism and celebrating democratic economies, is that, you know, this list says if you have ambition, if you have a great idea, and if you have a lot of luck, you got to have a lot of luck to get on this list. There are opportunities to make it happen. And while wealth is, you know, one good measure of success, and just one good measure of success, it's important that we put out this magazine. And yes, we're celebrating, but it also does show the centers of power within the United States. I mean, these people are the people who control certain aspects of the economy, especially if you look at our two finance sections, the big wheel section and the money bag section. These are financiers that I spend a lot of time with talking to. These people control markets, and it should not be downplayed the power that they have over the economy.
Now, it's not exactly the same list as last year. As you point out, 45 new names on the Forbes 400. Of course, it's interesting. Among the 45, 10 from one family, the Pritzkers, where a fortune was split up, and so 10 individuals joined the list. Five from another family, the Johnsons of S.C. Johnson and Sons, again, with fortunes being split up, I assume.
Right.
So the inheritance is not a small factor in getting on this list. But then there's another 30 who made it on without that happening.
Right. Purely self-made. When you talk about the 45 new members, half of them come from money management or from finance. You mentioned the Pritzkers. Those 10 go in that category because they run a conglomerate. We have people like Chris Flowers, who is a leveraged buyout titan. Mm-hmm. He bought a bank in Japan called Shinsei Bank, was able to flip it, and has about $1 billion. We have a new guy named Bill Gross, who I spent about 3 or 4 months tracking in Los Angeles. He's worth $1 billion. He's the chief investment officer and basically regarded as the best bond trader in the world at a company called PIMCO, which is in Newport Beach.
Yeah. Matt, there's a bunch we want to learn from you tonight about this list, but we want to invite some other guests in here as well. Joining us now from New York City is Edward Wolfe. He's professor of economics at New York University. He's research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Edward Wolfe, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
So we're getting sort of the big numbers here and a little bit of the titillation about the size of these fortunes, but we really want to take a few swings tonight at coming to grips with what these fortunes and this concentration of wealth mean for the United States. Edward Wolfe, how do you see the impact of this on the concentration of wealth, that is, on American business, on the way business is done, on what kind of business gets done and with what kind of focus? Is there a fingerprint of concentration of wealth that you can see in the American economy?
Well, I think, as Matt Miller pointed out, there certainly are political implications, and I guess that will be talked about later. But as far as directly economic implications, one result is that sort of the consumption that's being done in this country is very oriented towards the rich. We've had this huge increase of the luxury goods markets. We've seen these mega houses being built. We've seen people owning two or three vacation homes. So there is a reorientation of a lot of businesses towards catering to the rich, a whole new set of services that have been oriented towards the rich. So in a sense, they're kind of driving a lot of the economic activity that's going on in the country.
So that means a lot of luxury consumption. What about the economy itself? When you look at an economy where the concentration of wealth is growing, and we heard how much it's grown since the 1970s, is that a sign of health, of ill health? Does it matter whether wealth is concentrated or not in terms of how well an economy performs?
Well, I think I think there's, first of all, the moral issue. I think rather than praising or giving sort of a positive note on this increasing concentration of wealth, I think it's really morally reprehensible for so much of the country's resources to be going to such a small share of the population. So I think there's that aspect.
We get that, but as an economist, I mean, we totally understand what you're saying there. And again, that's in part a matter of personal outlook and ideology, depending how you look at it. Some people still celebrate it and say that. But that's, I guess, what I want to know from you as an economist. Does it have an effect on an economy's rate of growth, on its ultimate benefit for all of its members, for good or ill?
There is one aspect that I think will affect economic growth, and it's in a sense, a little ironic because the rich are bigger savers than the middle class or the poor. So as more resources are oriented or go into the hands of the rich, the actual consumption level will decline. And as a result, this will have a depressing effect on economic growth. So there is that aspect to it. But I think this is more or less overridden by the fact that the rich control so much of the resources of the country, and I think that's really what we should probably focus on.
Matt Miller, when you speak with members of this list, do they must be aware of the general trend in the United States toward a greater concentration of wealth. Are they still able to celebrate the old, you know, I made this fortune, and fortune-making raises ultimately all boats, and it's good for me, good for the country? Is that still the mindset of the Forbes 400 members?
It's very rare.
Sorry, Matt Miller, if you would.
Okay, yeah. It's very rare for me to be talking to a billionaire about these types of topics. Usually I'm trying to find out how they made their worth. But let me tell you, most of these guys, would prefer that I'd not call them. They'd prefer not to be on the list. They'd prefer. There's very few members of this list that actually are vying to get their net worth up, per se. Most of these guys are about the deal. They're about the idea. They're about getting things done. And their net worth is simply a way of measuring how they've done, usually. When they talk about high concentration of net worth and these types of things, you know, skewing towards the rich and, you know, the poor are getting poor. It's, you know, a lot of these guys would love to be talking about the philanthropy that they do. Bill Gates has given over $25 billion away trying to help people with AIDS and terrible diseases around the world. I don't think that it is morally reprehensible to be this rich. If these 400 weren't this rich, another 400 would be rich. And so while we have certainly the trends towards the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer and the middle class getting squeezed, I don't see a situation where we have you know, what John Edwards would call two Americas. There's actually probably three or four there. There's the ultra-rich. There's the poor. There are the people who live paycheck to paycheck. And then there are the people who are well-to-do but certainly can't retire. And I think it's a little more complex than just saying it's richer, ultra-rich and poor.
I think
you exactly pointed out the problem. If the population in general is getting better off, and you had this growing concentration of wealth, I don't think it would be as morally reprehensible. But we've had a long period of time when the middle class, as you said, has been squeezed, hasn't really seen much growth in their standard of living. And we've had a long period of time when wages have not risen at all and, in fact, have actually declined.
Brief time in the 90s where they rose. I want to turn to our callers. Kasky's calling. I'm sorry, Ed Wolf, what were you saying there? They did?
No. If you go back to the early 1970s, the average real wage today is actually lower than it was 30 years ago. I mean, this is astounding. And on the other hand, you have this great increase of wealth. So, you know, I think if we were in a society where everyone was progressing over time, and so, you know, some people are doing a little bit better than others, we would say, you know, it's probably all right. You know, we'll have these very rich people as long as everyone else is progressing. But we don't have that. We haven't had that in a generation, and I think that's what's really disturbing now.
Edward Wolf,
Tom, if I can interject real fast before we go to these callers, just to kind of take what Mr. Wolf is saying. There are, when we look internationally at concentrations of wealth, there's about 600 billionaires in the world, 300 of them, or 313 are here in the U.S. But if you look at countries that don't have billionaires, countries like the Congo, Egypt, Iran, Ethiopia, Pakistan, Vietnam, and the Ukraine, these people certainly have a lower standard of living than we do here in the United States. And I think when we talk about celebrating capitalism, celebrating democracy, celebrating the opportunity to go out and make a dollar, those countries don't have that. Their standard of living much poorer much likely, you know, that they're living under a dictator.
We've got a lot of ways to look at that at that pile of money, but then still, once it's there, a lot of ways to slice it. Edward Wolff, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Edward Wolff, professor of economics at New York University. This is On Point. Caskey is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Caskey, you're on the air.
Hi. My question was regarding the philanthropic ventures of all these billionaires and millionaires. My question is, how much of this $1 trillion is actually going towards charitable activities and events? And is it something that's evenly distributed among all these people, or is it concentrated in certain areas?
Let us pick that up, Caskey, and thanks for your call. Matt Miller, you've looked at the philanthropic activity of these top 400. What's it look like?
Some people give away a lot of money, and some people don't give any at all. If you look at the top 20 givers of the Forbes 400, Bill Gates has given, in sheer dollars, he's given the most away. He's given away about $30 billion, which is actually 37% of his net worth. If you did a philanthropic adjusted number for Bill Gates, he'd actually be worth about $76 billion.
And what percentage give a significant portion in your tally?
Well, eyeballing the top 20, I don't have all 400 in front of me, but eyeballing the top 20, I would say 50% give as much as 30% of their wealth away, whereas someone like Warren Buffett has only given away 1% of his net worth. It is truly across the spectrum when you look at the Forbes 400 as to who's giving what away, both in terms of sheer dollars and percentage of net worth.
So a huge range. I want to turn now to Columbus, Ohio, where we're joined by Lisa Keister. She's associate professor of sociology at Ohio State University, author of Getting Rich, America's New Rich and How They Got There. Lisa Keister, thanks for joining us tonight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We want to look at the cultural and sociological impact of this concentration of wealth, the footprint of these 400 wealthy and the general concentration of wealth in the country. Do you see, a pattern or an effect that you can describe of this greater and greater concentration of wealth in recent years on the culture, on our society, Lisa Keister?
Well, as Ed pointed out, and he's quite right, that the first issue has to be the moral issue, that this degree of concentration really is morally reprehensible. And if you and one thing that Ed didn't mention is that if you look at, instead of net worth, which includes your house and your financial assets, if you just look at financial wealth, you find that the top 1% own much closer to 50% of the total wealth. And so that kind of wealth is the kind that you really do save for retirement or
more liquid wealth.
Exactly, the liquid wealth. Exactly, mm-hmm. The kind of the money you can fall back on if a primary breadwinner loses a job, for instance. And that kind of wealth is even more concentrated. It's concentrated to a degree that really can't be described as anything other than reprehensible. I think Ed's term is exactly right. But if you look at the benefits that wealth brings, the job opportunities and the educational opportunities and the ability to, say, buy yourself a house in a safe and pleasant neighborhood, opportunities for your kids and those sorts of things, then if you think about the people who have zero or negative net worth, they have nothing, that's about 20% of the population. Mm. And those people are really just left out entirely in this picture.
So there's the other end of the spectrum. We've got to take a short break. We want to come back and look more closely at the sociology of this wealth and its concentration. Lisa Keister, Matt Miller, Jack Beattie, please stand by. Listeners, you can join our conversation tonight. Do you see conspicuous consumption to match this wealth, or are the rich retreating to their gated enclaves? Is this concentration of wealth a sign of economic vigor or of plutocracy, of oligarchy? How do you see it? We're talking about the wealthiest Americans and what their wealth means for the rest of us. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the wealthiest Americans and what their wealth means for the rest of the country. You can join the conversation tonight. Where are America's bountiful, top-heavy riches pushing the country? Is this concentration of wealth a sign of economic vigor or of plutocracy, of oligarchy? How do you see it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from New York by Matthew Miller, reporter for Forbes magazine, who helped compile and report this year's Forbes 400, a list of the richest individuals in the country, 78% wealth of $1 billion or more, average north of $2 billion. We're joined from Columbus, Ohio by Lisa Keister. She's associate professor of sociology at Ohio State University and author of Getting Rich. Lisa, we were talking just about the culture that surrounds this, and you picked up right away on Edward Wolfe's sort of moral condemnation of this, but that is there, and many people will make that argument. But what about at a cultural level? Does it change the texture of a society, the shape of a culture, when wealth becomes so concentrated? As a sociologist, how do you see the impact, not just in terms of who eats and who doesn't, who has a nice house and who doesn't? You spoke to that, and that's critical. The bottom line here. But what about in behavioral terms?
In behavioral terms, well, it is difficult to estimate how people behave as a response to this. There are people who guess that, or who argue that people will just feel less motivated because there's such inequality. But I think what you tend to see more than that is that this kind of inequality reinforces the structure that you already have in a society. For instance, you tend to have a higher concentration of African Americans and Hispanics at the bottom, and you see very few people from minority races at the top.
And why would that be magnified by the concentration of wealth?
Because the fact that the rich do get richer, and that we haven't seen growth at the bottom, means that the people who are rich are going to continue to be at the top, and the people at the bottom are going to have less of a chance of moving up.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that there's no wealth mobility, and in fact, there is significant wealth mobility.
Yes.
But characteristics like race and divorced women who with kids in particular, other groups like the rural poor, tend to be stuck in the bottom. And the fact that those groups have a really difficult time, that is, you know, getting out of the bottom, suggests that a concentration of wealth might reify these kinds of divisions in the society.
Mm. Let's turn to our callers. Amitava is calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Amitava. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
So thanks for taking my call. So this is my observation. From newspapers, I can see that the senators in the U.S. Senate, like, they're independently wealthy. All of them are multi-million dollars.
Many are now, sure.
Many are, yes. So, and also, I tried to go to a website of a Senate campaign, and if you do not donate more than $500 to the campaign, you can't even do a voice chat with an email chat with the campaign. So the bottom line is, if you are only independently rich, you can be in the legislature. And if you are writing the laws, whom are you going to write the laws for? For the rich buddies or for the rest of the population? I'm not necessarily saying that they're doing it on a purpose. I think they might even not know what the need of the poor population is, or the middle class of the average population.
Maybe just too far from that experience. Amitava, thanks very much for the point. To answer, I want to turn to Austin, Texas, where James Galbraith joins us. He's professor of government at the University of Texas, author of Inequality and Industrial Change, A Global View. He was executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. James Galbraith, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Our caller looks at the Forbes 400 we're describing tonight and the increasing concentration of wealth in the United States and raises this question about the political impact of that, particularly when so many actual elected representatives of the people are now wealthy themselves. How do you see the impact on American politics of this growing concentration of wealth?
Well, this is an old story. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations wrote that wealth is power, as Mr. Hobbes said. And I think that captures the point just made by the caller.
It's an old story, but it ebbs and flows, and we're at a flow right now for those that have got. They get.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, actually. We had an enormous increase in private financial wealth at the end of the last decade, a lot of it in the hands of some very young and people. At least, you know, if you measure wealth as they tend to do by valuing the people's portfolios at their market price,
right.
And then it crashed in 2000, 2001, and I think there was like $7 trillion of of financial wealth was simply wiped out in the first year or two of the Bush administration.
But for all that, the trend line, unless I've got this wrong, is a growing concentration of wealth from the 70s right on through until to now, essentially.
That is no doubt true of the group you're talking to, about the Forbes 400.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the larger population, in the top 1% and 5%, you've had a huge decline in stock values. And what the one big exception is in the arms industry, which has had a big increase in the stock valuations in the last 2 years, really since the beginning of the Iraq War. And that's where the economy has been concentrating wealth over the last year or so, almost nowhere else.
But Lisa Keister, when I look at your research, I'm quoting you here, I believe, saying research suggests that the U.S. has now surpassed all industrial societies in the extent of family wealth inequality. That's part of concentration. James Galbraith, surely that has a political impact.
Well, as I say, it certainly does. But the specific political impact is the one I'm pointing to. 5 years ago, the hot political players were the information technology tycoons.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the chief executive of Halliburton, of Bechtel, of Boeing, of Lockheed Martin, the specific companies who have benefited from the economy that we've got now.
That's right, and Jamie's right to say that there was a little bit of an ebb in the early 2000s when the stock market was crashing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit less inequality.
It hasn't recovered.
So,
hasn't recovered. No, it hasn't.
So when these words plutocracy and oligarchy get thrown around, James Galbraith, how do you respond to that?
Well, we have a government which is essentially an oligarchy. It represents a very small handful of large corporate interests. It ignores almost all other organized community. Organized labor has no role. The environmental movement has no role. The civil rights community has no role. This is a government which is responsive to the arms industry, the oil industry, big pharmaceuticals, big media. That's who they work for. That's a plutocracy.
And Matt Miller, off the Forbes 400, what did you find about political activity, political contributions? How do they sort out between, let's say, Republicans and Democrats?
72% of the Forbes 400 have donated to Bush, 28% to the Democrats or John Kerry, and that is of those who have donated any kind of money. Not everybody gives any money to political campaigns. The biggest Bush contributors are Bill Gates, John Walton, and Michael Dell. Biggest Kerry contributors are Ann Cox Chambers, the Sandler family, and Sumner Redstone.
But 72% Bush, 28% Kerry. Lisa Keister, that confirms a pretty pronounced tilt.
It does. It's a little surprising that Bill Gates is giving money to Bush, and yet his father is campaigning against the abolition of the estate tax.
The Bushes aren't the only family in which there may be some father-son dynamic.
Well, you also have to look at this one, and he, I think,
is on to something extraordinarily important.
The estate tax
has greatly mitigated the damage done by the private accumulation of wealth because it gives really rich people a very strong incentive to put a lot of their money into nonprofit organizations and private foundations, basically to take it out of the control of their heirs. And that is something which has given our country as a whole a huge set of institutions which don't exist in Europe and other places and which I think really have made the private accumulation of capital tolerable in a way it would not have been over the last century.
But, of course, that estate tax itself, in the sights of the Bush administration and already pared back quite a bit. With that, we are out of time. Matt Miller, thanks so much for unfolding this list for us a bit tonight.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
Matt Miller, reporter for Forbes magazine, helped report the Forbes 400. And James Galbraith in Austin, Texas, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. And Lisa Keister at Ohio State University, author of Getting Rich, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Jack, I just wanted to sit with you on this subject for a minute. We've got about a minute left here, but it's still remarkable. This country produces incredible wealth and over time distributes it in rather different patterns. We're in one of those waves right now.
We are, and the egalitarian institutions, the public school, unions, countervailing power on the part of the federal government, all of these things have been pulled back, and the result is we're returning to 19th century standards where 40%, perhaps in the next decade, 50% of the wealth in the top 1%. What did Oliver Goldsmith say? Ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe politics turn it around. What do you think, Jack? Is it going to swing the other way?
It's happened in the past. All of these big run-ups have met with popular reactions, and that seems to be a law of American politics. When it'll come, I don't know.
We'll be watching as on we go. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is On Point. John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation today announced the winners of this year's so-called Genius Grants. The 23 honorees will each receive $500,000, no strings attached. The winners include a molecular biologist, a marine roboticist, a glass technologist, a ragtime pianist, and a former barber turned bookseller. Ruben Martinez Bookstore is now one of the largest commercial sellers of Spanish language books. It all began when he started lending books to customers at his barber shop in Santa Ana, California. Now retired from the haircutting business, the 64-year-old Martinez has fostered a store that is a cornerstone of Hispanic culture and educational events in California. In this radio diary, Ruben Martinez explains how his barbershop grew into a national literary powerhouse and how he became perhaps the most surprising of this year's class of MacArthur Grant recipients.
Well, I've always been a lifelong reader, always. From 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, I started reading. I just got hooked, and I used to hide from my friends because they used to make fun of me reading. And my mother wanted me to go work in the backyard instead of reading. So I used to lock myself in the outhouses, the toilets that we used to have, reading, and nobody bothered me there. But I went on to high school, and that was it. You know, I've been a barber most of my life, a haircutter. And I always had good books. People always borrowed them, never to return them. That was 1993. So not knowing anything about the book business, we started out with two books. And then we purchased five. And then we went on to 10, and then 25, and then 100. That was 11 years ago. And my accountant has told me that we have sold over $2.5 million now since then. We're a very active bookstore. We have a lot of activities. We have some of the nation's finest authors that come here. And what our mission here is to create a revolution of readers, to get young people to start reading at young ages, for parents to start reading to them out loud at home. Some days, on Saturdays and Sundays, 100% of the books that we sell are in Spanish. Yes, we are readers. We are reading. Latino people, Spanish speakers, they don't know where to buy books. That's all. We have the finest selection. We have the best books anybody could have at home. And we also have a children's bookstore. And then other cultures, like we have African-American books, Jewish books, Irish books, Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Cambodian, all the cultures you can think of, Vietnamese, because we want these Mexican children to learn about other cultures in this world. And this is what it's all about. The 21st century is a century of languages and cultures. For us, it's just an opportunity. It's like the mountain going to Muhammad with good literature. And our audiences have grown because it's not only here at the bookstore. We're on radio and we're on TV once a week recommending books and talking about the importance of reading, parents reading to their children and making a difference. And just participating, being givers, and just being there, and enjoying it, and just enjoying it. So we've been blessed. Somebody's looking out for us, but they found us when we really enjoy what we're doing.
Ruben Martinez is the owner of Libreria Martinez Books and Art Gallery in Santa Ana, California, and one of 23 winners of this year's MacArthur Fellows Program. The winners were announced earlier today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.